Brexit and how we deal with Brexit is now at such an extent of confusion and disagreement that we really do need you to interact together with us today on this programme. You know, some people have been saying recently that they're sick to death of hearing about Brexit. If you look at any of the national newspapers this morning, you've got people within the Conservative Party devising strategies to topple Theresa May. You've got the DUP over the weekend issuing threats to Theresa May as to what they will do if they break, if the Conservatives break the DUP's, as they've described it, blood red line. The Irish border issue is now one of the most prominent conundrums throughout the whole discussion in Europe as to how Brexit will happen. So this place is at the very centre of the debate. And we're going to discuss that in a moment or two. Another aspect of what I want to discuss today, over the last probably 7-8 days, I've been trying to interview as many Tory MPs as possible to try to get a sense of what their understanding is. If the Irish border issue is at the centre of this conundrum, trying to get an understanding, well, what are all these Conservative MPs who live across the water, what is their understanding of the Irish border issue? Have they read up on it? Have they knowledge about it? So I want to start off this morning by sharing with you an interview that I did on BBC Radio 5 live last night with a Tory MP called Andrew Bridgen. And I was going through all the different Northern Irish versions, the different Northern Irish questions with him to get a grasp of his understanding. And in terms of the very simple knowledge that he should have as to, well, who's entitled to an Irish passport, who's entitled to a British passport, how will that affect the future? Here's Mr. Bridgen's understanding. Are you committed, Andrew, to ensuring that Northern Ireland is not treated differently to the rest of the UK?
I am, yes.
But the Conservative government already accepts that Northern Ireland is different. Because after Brexit, no matter what happens, people in Northern Ireland, unlike the rest of the UK, will still have the right to be EU citizens. That's your position. You put that in your own Brexit position paper in Ireland.
Well, that's the common travel area as well, isn't it? We do have the right to go over to Ireland, don't we? As an English person, I have the right to go to Ireland. I believe I can ask for a passport, can't I? Reciprocal agreement where I can go to Ireland and ask for an Irish passport and someone from Ireland can come to the UK and ask for a British passport. We have that system. That's the system we have, isn't it?
Sorry, hold on. You think there is a reciprocal agreement where you as an English person can come over and get an Irish passport?
I can apply for Irish citizenship, yes.
You think there's a reciprocal... Can we just stop the news bed? Can you tell me what that reciprocal agreement is?
I believe that's in the common travel area, isn't it?
You believe as an English person, as an Englishman, that there exists in legislation a reciprocal agreement where you can be given an Irish passport?
I can apply for an Irish passport, yes.
Well, of course you can. Someone in Japan can apply for an Irish passport. And so that interview went on. The Alliance Party, Stephen Farry, with us this morning. Stephen, morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
And the Ulster Unionist Party, Steve Aiken. Morning to you, Steve.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Stephen, this morning.
So, Steve Aiken, let's start with you today. I think there is a job to be done in trying to understand how much knowledge lots of these Tory MPs, who ultimately will be voting on this, actually have about Northern Irish affairs. And now you have a prominent Brexiteer, Andrew Bridgen, thinking, completely wrongly thinking, that any English person can apply for an Irish passport and anybody living in Ireland can automatically get a British passport out of something made up in his head about a reciprocal agreement that doesn't exist.
Stephen, the level of knowledge amongst a lot of Tory MPs and MPs generally about Northern Ireland is shockingly low. And one of the things, and I'm a member of the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly, and one of the things I spend a lot of time doing is talking to MPs and other members of the regional assemblies about the issues we do have here in Northern Ireland. And one of the other things I have to spend a lot of time doing, and I think it's very unfortunate, I have to spend a lot of time briefing UK government civil servants who should be much better aware of what happens in Northern Ireland as well as some of the issues. And it is a shockingly low level of knowledge. And one of the things as Northern Ireland politicians we need to do is we need to get out and about and explain the Northern Ireland situation as clearly as we can. Because one of the issues we have at the moment is that one of the views in England, and you'll have seen it from your Five Live programme and being in Manchester, is everybody's now focusing on what the DUP say about Northern Ireland and the DUP's view. There are many other views, and those are important views that we get across, and that's something we need to, and as members of the Ulster Unionist Party, we have been doing. We've been talking in Scotland, we've been talking to the Welsh, we've been talking in London, we've been in Brussels, and trying to explain there's more positions just than the DUP position, or indeed the Sinn Féin position, which seems to be the only one that's getting heard in the mainstream media at the moment.
And Stephen Fry, let's get your reaction to what you've heard. Look, it is one MP. What we're actually going to do in the Nolan Show tomorrow is build a montage of the different Tory MPs who I've been interviewing over recent days and weeks, who have got shocking basics about Northern Ireland, shockingly wrong. And the point is this, that they are going to be voting on an issue where they need to have a knowledge of Northern Ireland, because that's what the border issue is.
And Stephen, that's right. I mean, some of the comments from the Tory backbenchers are completely absurd. But the more fundamental problem is that we are also seeing that from people who are, in effect, cabinet ministers or former cabinet ministers, who, and people, for example, who were advocating for Brexit, have very little understanding of the complexities of Northern Ireland and the vulnerabilities of Northern Ireland in the context of Brexit. I mean, Boris Johnson and David Davis stand out as two particular examples in that regard, but it is much more widespread in terms of the Conservative Party and indeed elements of the London civil service as well. And in part explains why we're in such a mess today, because people didn't think through what they were doing. And the lack of a plan at the moment, I think, is deeply, deeply, deeply concerning. We're in a really, really difficult spot. And the real tragedy of this is we actually have an offer on the table from Brussels that not only just protects Northern Ireland, but could be turned to our advantage. Yeah. I mean, this is something we've been pushing for the best part of a year in terms of this notion of the fit in both camps. And we're in danger of actually losing that way through Brexit, through the intransigence, in particular, of the DUP at present.
There's a lot to talk about today. 030-30-80-55-55. Before we move on from this, I just want to let you hear once again the understanding from a prominent Brexiteer, Conservative MP, of the rules around British and Irish citizenship and availability to get a passport. Are you committed, Andrew, to ensuring that Northern Ireland is not treated differently to the rest of the UK?
I am, yes.
But the Conservative government already accepts that Northern Ireland is different. Because after Brexit, no matter what happens, people in Northern Ireland, unlike the rest of the UK, will still have the right to be EU citizens. That's your position. You put that in your own Brexit position paper in Ireland.
Well, that's the common travel area as well, isn't it? We do have the right to go over to Ireland, don't we? As an English person, I have the right to go to Ireland. I believe I can ask for a passport, can't I? Reciprocal agreement where I can go to Ireland and ask for an Irish passport and someone from Ireland can come to the UK and ask for a British passport. We have that system. That's the system we have, isn't it?
Sorry, hold on. You think there is a reciprocal agreement where you as an English person can come over and get an Irish passport?
I can apply for Irish citizenship, yes.
You think there's a reciprocal... Can we just stop the news bed? Can you tell me what that reciprocal agreement is?
I believe that's in the common travel area, isn't it?
You believe as an English person, as an Englishman, that there exists in legislation a reciprocal agreement where you can be given an Irish passport?
I can apply for an Irish passport, yes.
Well, of course you can. Someone in Japan can apply for an Irish passport.
Someone in Papua New Guinea can apply for an Irish passport as well, but there's no reciprocal agreement. What actually happened was we were heading towards the midnight news. Mr. Pridgen then hung up, and when we tried to get him back, we were getting his answer machine. There's been quite a lot of reaction to that on Twitter. Here's the point, Steve Aiken, let's start with you, that I was trying to get to. This is how this came up last night. We hear the DUP's Arlene Foster and others saying that they will not tolerate any difference between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK post-Brexit. But of course, written, and this is the point I was trying to get to, written in to the agreement is actually the reality that Northern Ireland will be treated differently than the rest of the UK, because every Northern Irish citizen is able to apply for an Irish passport and therefore, in so doing, getting all of those EU rights that nobody in England, Scotland or Wales who has not got Irish heritage will be able to get. So there is a fundamental difference already built into the future.
Well, Stephen, the fundamental difference was built in the Belfast Agreement in 1998, which our party worked very hard to sort of break the cycle of the past so we can get actually get the principles' consent as being about the future where we're going. But just to digress slightly, when you're talking about the Tory MPs, I would also ask you to ring up some of the Labour MPs and some of the MPs from the SNP, because the knowledge about Northern Ireland is shockingly small across all parties, not just the Conservatives. And bearing in mind the importance that any votes that are likely to come up and the important role that both the Labour and SNP are likely to do.
But I just want
just
the...
Just for the sake of power, fair enough.
Yeah, but
ring a few of them. But, you know, I fully agree with your premise of the rest of it.
But I want the public to know. I just want to set this out for the public this morning. We've got lots of time here. But I want to set out for the public that in the Conservative Party's own Brexit position paper on Ireland, they say in paragraph 14, I was looking at this overnight last night, right? And here's what they say, quote, as long as Ireland remains a member of the EU, Irish citizenship also confers EU citizenship with all the rights that go with this. This is as true for the people of Northern Ireland who are Irish citizens or who hold both British and Irish citizenship as it is for Irish citizens in Ireland. So what that means is job rights, human rights. So that means job rights, that means human rights. So when we hear any politician from any political party saying, but we don't want any difference between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, it is written in to the Tory plan, their own Brexit position paper in Ireland, that we will have different status. And indeed, we do. Fact. Indisputable, Steve.
Same. We've got different rules and regulations for Scotland. We've got different rules and regulations for Wales. It's all part and parcel of the mixture that is United Kingdom. That is part and parcel of it. And that we go back to the importance of the Belfast Agreement that the Ulster Unionist Party helped bring into the fore and the rest of it. That says very categorically, first of all, around the position of consent, but also, yes, if you want to designate yourself as Irish or you are living in Northern Ireland, you can be deemed to be British, Irish, both, or whatever. And that doesn't change.
And crucially, have all of those EU rights that people in England, Scotland and Wales will not have. That's my point this morning. We've got special status already.
But the special status we have is based on the Belfast Agreement, Stephen. That is the key to where we're going to, and that's what we need to keep going. The importance is that people don't recognise the importance of what the Belfast Agreement did, particularly amongst members of the Conservative Party and some of the Labour Party. And it's important that that's recognised. And we can't keep on using the Belfast Agreement as some form of political football to be kicked back and forth, to be used to be pushing people like Sinn Féin's agenda on trying to get us towards United Ireland or any other agendas. The Belfast Agreement is what the fundamental principle is. The Conservatives haven't been able to articulate that. The knowledge, and Stephen Farrell and I will disagree on lots of things, but the knowledge that has been demonstrated by most people about Northern Ireland, about the Belfast Agreement, and about the importance of east-west, north-south cooperation on these islands is fundamental and it's clear. And the lack of knowledge across the board, whether it's in London, whether it's in Brussels, and indeed whether it's in Dublin, has been absolutely shockingly poor.
Now, what's your problem with goods being checked? Why have you got a problem with goods post-Brexit being checked before they go to the rest of the UK? Steve
being
Aiken.
Checked post-Brexit, being checked going to the UK.
Well, the so-called border down the Irish Sea, how would that threaten the union? Really, how would it threaten the union?
Well, the key issue about that is when we start having different regulations going back and forth across the United Kingdom, and it starts forming internal borders, and we start seeing things like price differentials, we start seeing difference in movements of goods and the timeline that that takes place. And the key thing to it, above all, and this is why we are fundamentally opposed to the backstop, is under what legal system will Northern Ireland be sitting at after if the backstop was did come to the fore? Is what has primacy? Is it the laws of Northern Ireland? Is it the European Court of Justice? Who has the control over those? What does the say of the people of Northern Ireland in those rules, and what is the likelihood of that, bearing in mind there isn't even an assembly or even likelihood to do that as well? The joint committee, and Stephen, we're going to have, you know, there is so many layers of complexity in this one as well. This idea of a joint committee that will be able to somehow administer Northern Ireland as part of some kind of EU subset within the UK, it is so flawed. And it so goes against the fundamentals, and I go back again to the fundamentals of the Belfast Agreement, that changes the whole idea of the principle of consent. Because the question for business people in Northern Ireland, and indeed for things like environmental legislation and issues to do with that, who would actually have primacy? Would it be the European Court, which we have no say in? Would it be Northern Ireland laws? Would it be the Supreme Court? Would it be whatever? Those are the fundamental things which will break up the fundamentals of the United Kingdom. And I don't even want to get on to what the issues are likely to be in Scotland and what Ruth Davison and what Nicola Sturgeon's been saying as well. But these are key issues that need to be answered.
Stephen Farry?
Well, we've seen some hysterical talk this morning, not from Steve, I must stress, but from others, talking about this being a battle for the union. I mean, let me be very clear.
That's Nigel Dodds said that, isn't it?
That was Nigel Dodds. And it shows a certain degree of desperation that's now setting into people's arguments. Look, the backstop is not something anyone particularly wants. I mean, it's only there as an insurance policy, a safety net. It's there because we are Brexiting and other options have been ruled out so far that would avoid the need for the backstop having to be put in place. But let me be very, very clear. Northern Ireland remains part of the UK under the backstop, and the principle of consent continues to apply. And there'll be no change unless the people of Northern Ireland decide otherwise in a referendum. This is a practical economic intervention to protect the very particular circumstances of Northern Ireland. And whenever we're put in a situation where choices have to be made, yes, there will be a limited degree of additional friction in terms of some of the checks that have to be put in place. But at the same time, we have the opportunity to have that bridge to the European Union and to continue to be part of the UK market, and we should be seizing that particular opportunity.
We should probably remind people what the backstop is. The EU has proposed a backstop that would essentially mean Northern Ireland staying in the EU customs union, large parts of the single market, and the EU VAT system. That's basically what they've... Every time you hear about backstop... That's what you hear it is. But why is that a problem for the UK? Well, it being a problem is a bit of an understatement, isn't it? Because if the backstop only applies to Northern Ireland, then that's why politicians from within the DUP and others are saying that the customs and regulatory border is essentially drawn down the middle of the Irish Sea. It would give separate status for Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. And that's where people like Nigel Dodds is saying that this helps to contribute to this being a battle for the union because it's potentially damaging to the union as a whole.
There's another way of looking at this, Stephen. Because Northern Ireland is such a divided society, we're such in a vulnerable situation, the backstop actually will provide some degree of stability. People actually are prepared to get behind it and recognise that it brings a degree of coherence and cohesion to our society. It may actually end up stabilising the union.
Well, the DP aren't going to have it, and Steve Aiken, the Ulster Unionist Party aren't going to have it either, right?
No, well, sorry, Stephen, we're moving to the system where, if we looked at people in Brussels, and I've talked to them about this, used to talk about sort of Northern Ireland as being one country, two systems. But what we're looking at is sort of one country, three systems, and some form of quasi-EU sovereignty over Northern Ireland to do with trade and other issues pertaining to that. And other issues pertaining to that will stretch into things like environmental legislation, that will stretch into the energy markets, it'll stretch into a wide variety of issues. And it is going to make Northern Ireland fundamentally different from the United Kingdom. And I know we can go into the argument and say Northern Ireland is already different from Scotland or Wales or England or whatever it happens to be. But the reality is that would indeed place significant boundaries between how we link ourselves between Northern Ireland and the rest of Great Britain. And that is something, as a unionist, I can't and our party will not put up with.
But we do that already, Stephen.
We go into a situation that... No, we don't, to that degree.
Look at the electricity market as a clear example, which you support, which is an all-island approach.
No, it is an all-island single electricity market. Let's talk about the electricity market at the moment.
Yeah, no, it is an all-island. But that's the point Stephen Fry is making to you, Steve Aiken. That all-island electricity market is different than the market in the rest of the UK. Doesn't threaten the union, does it?
But it's moving toward an all-island electricity market.
Yes, yes. And that doesn't threaten the union, does it?
The key to it at the moment is our ability to maintain security and sustainability of supply in Northern Ireland.
The issue with
the ISIM in particular, and one of the questions being asked by the major generating companies and the system as well, under what jurisdiction, what legal jurisdiction would the system be under?
Well,
now, bearing in mind, it's quite a complicated issue, so it just can't be sort of dealt with in sort of one quick soundbite. The issue at the moment is there is no north-south interconnector. And the reality is that Northern Ireland increasingly will need to rely on the interconnector with Scotland to be able to maintain that.
The question
as we go forward...
I don't think we should get wrapped up in interconnectors this morning because I can't follow this.
Stephen, that is the problem with this issue.
Yes.
Is there are so many complexities to it. There are so many different layers to it. There is no simple answer. The backstop is not a simple answer.
Can I ask a different question? And Stephen Farry, do you have a legal background, Stephen?
Me? No, but I have a political science background.
Right. Well, maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here this morning. But from what I've been obsessing about overnight, sometimes I do this, right? Mm-hmm. What's written into this Brexit position paper on Ireland, the Conservative Party Brexit position paper on Ireland, which is basically saying again, let me read it out, and there's a reason why I'm doing this. As long as Ireland remains a member of the EU, Irish citizenship also confers EU citizenship with all the rights that go with it, right? And they say this is as true for the people of Northern Ireland who are Irish citizens as it is for Irish citizens in Ireland. So here's my question. For the people in Northern Ireland who are Irish citizens, they have an Irish passport, right?
Yep.
Does that mean that no matter what the DUP and other Brexiteers say, does that mean that after Brexit, an Irish citizen who was running a court case in Northern Ireland would be able to introduce European law into a Northern Ireland UK court?
Well, that's a very complex question, Stephen.
But you know what?
Let me break it. I have an answer for you. Let me break it down into three elements. First of all, the UK government has already recognised that Northern Ireland does have a special status in terms of the negotiations because they've already signed up to the backstop in the joint report last December and also indicated that there should be a backstop in terms of their response.
But they haven't agreed what the backstop is.
No, they haven't agreed on the actual fine detail, but they have agreed on the principle of the backstop already. So let's be very clear that this is not a question of whether there's a backstop, it's a question of how the backstop...
Let's say I'm running a law case.
Right.
Let me set it out for the people.
Sure.
So let's say I'm running a legal case in Northern Ireland and I'm in a Northern Irish court. Mm-hmm. Now, I did go. I got an Irish passport a number of months ago, right?
Yep.
So I now hold a British passport and an Irish passport. It was actually a dupper, a DUPer, who signed my papers for an Irish passport, but that's another thing, right? So I've now got those two passports.
Mm-hmm.
If I am running post-Brexit, if I am in the middle of a court case, can I bring in and rely on the EU legislation, the European law, in a Northern Irish UK court?
Well, first of all, there is jurisdiction of the European Court on Human Rights, which is separate from the European Union, and that should remain the case regardless of what happens in terms of Brexit. In terms of your ability to cite European Union law, that is a much much more complex situation.
But if I wave my Irish passport and say I'm an Irish citizen, how can they stop me?
That is probably not going to be determined by which passport you have, but will be a function in terms of, for example, to what extent the European Charter on Fundamental Rights is recognised in terms of domestic UK law. But the more fundamental question you should be asking, Stephen, and this is something that, for example, the Committee on Administration of Justice and other people have been raising, is how far the European Union has actually gone to recognise those rights that Irish passport holders will have in terms of what is likely to unfold. Because the joint report says one thing from last December. However, there is a concern that those have been watered down somewhat in the negotiations since. So, for example, there are concerns about whether people who have an Irish passport in Northern Ireland will have rights to access, for example, healthcare and education facilities, because there's an argument that actually those aren't simply determined by the passport you have, but by residency inside the European Union. There's then a second question, which is in terms of, for example, under the Good Friday Agreement, there should be no difference between people who have a British passport and an Irish passport. If you're living in Northern Ireland, for example, neighbours in the same street, can we have a situation where an Irish passport holder has a different set of rights than a British passport holder? Like, I would argue that's a fundamental breach of the Good Friday Agreement, and we haven't got our heads around that just yet. Hopefully that was comprehensive enough, Stephen.
But Stephen, again, if you
Stephen has...
Sorry,
right.
Yeah.
Right, go ahead, Steve.
But Steve, if you were living in the same street and you had an Irish passport as someone who didn't, living in the same street, as I'm reading this, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but as I'm reading this, there's at least an argument that you would have all of those European rights that the person next door to you who doesn't have an Irish passport wouldn't have.
Well,
Steve Aiken?
That's one reading of it, but... Go ahead, Steve.
Right. There are too many Stevens on again this morning. Stephen, and I mean Stephen Nolan, this shows how fundamentally complex this issue is and has been made to be very, very complex. And when the Conservative Party wrote that particular piece of documentation, it shows how little they actually understood about what was going on and the complexities of where we're at and where we're likely to be at. Now, I'm not a legal expert, and like Stephen, my doctorate area is in international relations. You probably need to get Jim Allister to give the forensic barrister type view on what is likely to be this and the rest of it. But the key must be that...
I doubt he has an Irish passport.
Under the Belfast Agreement, we've got to get to the point where none of the rights within the Belfast Agreement are either watered down or in any way impeded with. And whatever comes out of the negotiations, that's the stage we need to get to. Now, Stephen, I don't know how we're going to get there, and there are much better and more brilliant minds than mine and Stephen Farry's who've been sort of ruminating about this, but I'm not seeing any sort of clear way ahead of this, because we are, quite frankly, in a mess, and the mess isn't getting any easier.
Thank you very much indeed. Here's Mervyn in Hollywood. Morning, Mervyn.
Good morning, Stephen. I don't think anybody knows what's going on, Stephen. Steve Egan was quite right there. The whole thing is a complete mess. And my only way out of it is to think is that when it comes to the House of Commons and we'll have a debate on the deal that Theresa May is going to do, I think there has to be a second referendum. It truthfully is simply because nobody knows what's going on.
Well, let's have a listen to what Nigel Dodds told the BBC this morning.
I do hope that the prospect of a no deal will actually force negotiators to realise on the EU side that the British government is serious, that we're serious, that Ruth Davidson's serious, that the Conservative Party are serious, that many in the Labour Party are serious when they say that the United Kingdom cannot be broken up. This is now clearly turning into a battle for the Union itself.
Turning into, that's a deputy leader of the DUP, Mervyn, saying that this is turning into a battle for the Union itself.
Created by the Democratic Unionist Party. That's what it is. It is created on Radio 4 two nights ago. It was said that Germany, France, Spain, Italy are all countries that support a united Ireland. That there is no shadow of a doubt. So that is what we are up against. We will become something like a bit of a nuisance. Just do whatever we like in Northern Ireland and get rid of it. You said yourself there, Stephen, we're talking to Tory MPs. I don't even think half of nowhere Northern Ireland is. But we're on the line here. We are putting our future and our children's futures on the line. This is what this is about. People voted not for the economy, not for employment, not for the fishing industry. They voted on immigration. That, and it's not even been talked about. The vast majority of people in England voted Brexit because of immigration. And if we don't get, if the people of this country go forth and don't get a say in it, I think we're heading for a disaster, Stephen.
Here's Michael in White Abbey. Morning, Michael.
Stephen, there's a question I would like to ask, and I have been trying to get to the bottom of it. At the present time, a person living in Northern Ireland who holds an English passport is entitled to a European medical card for emergency treatment in Europe, right? Now, a person who lives in Northern Ireland and holds an Irish passport, can they apply for a European medical card for emergency treatment? My understanding is to qualify, you must have an address in the Republic of Ireland or in Southern Ireland.
You mean post-Brexit?
Yes. Even now, at this moment in time, or even after Brexit, makes no difference. Now, after Brexit, the UK might say to the European Union, OK, we're going to have reciprocal arrangements for people who need emergency treatment. Are you with me? But at the present time, a person living in Northern Ireland can apply for a European emergency medical card. It used to be known as the E111, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you had to live in the UK to qualify for that. Now, if I decide, or anyone else who has an Irish passport living in Northern Ireland, can they apply for a medical card?
Post-Brexit? Well, they would be an Irish citizen. Ireland is part of the EU. So on face value, you would think that you could. But we need to get this checked. We need to get this checked with a mind bigger than mine. The commentator, Newton Emerson, with us this morning. Newton, Good morning. Where are we at with all of this? Do people in this country actually know what their rights are going to be post-Brexit?
No, and Stephen, I think it was mentioned earlier that this has been watered down a little bit between the two withdrawal agreements. The question you're puzzling over there about how an Irish passport will work depending on your northern or southern address, that is the key question. Are there going to be two classes of Irish passport, north and south? And EU law does allow a recognition of that.
Does it?
Yes, it does. Now, it's a case law that allows it. Case by case, countries can treat their nationals differently depending on what region they live. The classic example is the Kingdom of Denmark. Denmark is in the EU. Its citizens are full EU citizens, full EU rights. On the Faroe Islands, they're Danish as well. They're full Danish citizens, but not EU citizens. And in Greenland, they're also full EU. They're also full Danish citizens and still full EU citizens, even though they're outside the EU.
Can you see a situation, Newton, where the Irish government would not give all of those European rights to all Irish citizens, no matter which of the 32 counties they live in?
No, and I think it will have to, and I think the EU will have to as well. The point is that EU rules allow this. They even allow a variation in the amount of EU entitlement you've got. For example, UK citizens in Gibraltar have full EU rights, but UK citizens in the Cyprus sovereign base areas, they have free movement, but they can't vote in European elections. Bit by bit, EU law allows you to put together a deal on this. The question your current caller asked about the medical card, I think that's actually one of the things that might be a bit difficult to arrange, because you need reciprocal arrangements with everyone's health providers. And it's not clear that the medical card is a right. It might just be a benefit, and there is a slight legal difference in what that means. But this is an issue that can be sorted out. The problem is that nobody is sorting it out. So I think that once they actually get down to the nitty-gritty of tying this together, it's not going to be that difficult a problem.
Let's come back to what Nigel Dodds has told the BBC this morning, that this is now becoming a battle for the union. Is it?
Well, I'm afraid that politically it is, even though legally it doesn't have to be. You know, I listened to Stephen Farrey on earlier talking about why this shouldn't be a constitutional issue, the sea border, and I absolutely agree with him. But Alliance all along has pretended that a land border is a constitutional issue that would destroy the Good Friday Agreement. That's not true either. A lot of people are having their cake and eating it on this issue. A sea border isn't a constitutional issue. A hard border isn't a Good Friday Agreement issue. Everybody needs to de-dramatise all round.
So just for my kind of more simple mind, you've got goods post-Brexit. You've got these goods, for example, in Northern Ireland, right?
Uh-huh,
so you've
yep.
got, I don't know, you've got... Well, there's a possibility. Now, it's certainly not definite, but some people have been saying, look, chlorinated chicken, for example, that they have in America. Let's say that the UK decides they're outside of Europe now, they're outside of the EU now, and mm-hmm. the UK decides, right, we're gonna do a deal with Americans for chlorinated chicken, and the chlorinated chicken is in Northern Ireland, right? This is post Brexit.
Yes.
So how does the EU stop that chlorinated chicken getting into the EU across the Irish border? Where would the checks be?
The checks would either be in Britain or on the boat. The EU is talking about having checks on the boat, although people I've spoken to in the freight industry say you can't do that for health and safety reasons. But anyway, they might scan a barcode on the boat. Or the final opportunity would be at Belfast Harbour. But that chlorinated chicken under the current backstop agreement would be stopped. I don't think it could get into Northern Ireland at all. There has been previous talk about having red and green channels in the sea border where stuff bound for Northern Ireland could just be waved through, and stuff bound for the Republic would be stopped and checked, and then there'd be spot checks inside Northern Ireland to make sure everything was where it was meant to be, had ended up where it was meant to be.
So you're you're saying that chicken coming from America would be checked where?
It would be checked in Britain, on the boat, or in Belfast. I think that's not the real question. The question is, could it get into Northern Ireland at all? I think that the talk about a regulatory border in a lot of ways has been about, you know, the wattage of a kettle or the type of a plug size, you know, and would those goods be allowed into Northern Ireland if they didn't meet EU regulations? And I think they would have been. But you're talking about dramatic emotive issues like food, and also, of course, issues that are regulated very strongly already across the Irish Sea. Consider this possibility. If that chlorinated chicken was allowed into Northern Ireland and we had a pretty good system to ensure that it didn't leak across the border, would consumers in the EU still buy chicken from the Republic? Would they still be confident to? Would they be confident to buy chicken made here in Northern Ireland if we said, well, we don't put chlorine in it? I don't think so. I think that's an issue where you would start to see regulation becoming a pretty serious difference between here and Northern Ireland. The question is that a constitutional difference? I don't think so. It doesn't need to be. We, you know, we're quite happy to have different food standards and to trumpet them during the BSE crisis. We already have 100% inspections of live animals coming across the Irish Sea. This, I think, it's still something that could be de-dramatised. And remember, we're not all in the chlorinated chicken business. I mean, who does this really affect? It's people in this industry, and surely what they want takes primacy.
What impact? The DP, Arlene Foster, is saying that a hard Brexit is now likely. What impact does a hard Brexit have on us?
Well, let's get one thing straight here. There's no such thing as a no-deal Brexit.
Brexit is what I meant to say. Sorry.
There's a Brexit without the withdrawal agreement. But then you just immediately have to start making all the little deals that we'd be making after that anyway. The withdrawal agreement is like a kind of wrapper for all the little deals we'd need to do afterwards. We wouldn't get the wrapper next March, but we'd still have to go ahead and do all the little deals. So what a no-deal, pardon me, what a no-deal Brexit would mean is a pretty nasty bump in the road next March, months of chaos, I reckon. But then bit by bit, it would all, you know, that would all lessen and reduce. So I don't think anyone should wave their hands in the air and panic about a no-deal Brexit. The problem is, does that make it more likely? Is the fact that it's not a permanent catastrophe, does that increase the likelihood that the DUP might go ahead and risk it? I don't see ultimately them having the political power to do that. I think that the range of interests against them, it's just too great. And the regulatory sea border solution is just too good a solution for everyone else. I think the political gravity has to assert itself eventually.
If Nigel Dodds is right, and this has become a battle for the union, do you, Newton, think that some people within the DUP will be wondering why the DUP, through Brexit, have brought a battle for the union onto the cards?
Yes, I think that the DUP over the coming months might need a fall guy or fall girl for how things pan out. And so that might involve changes at the top.
So you're saying this is Arlene Foster's fault?
No, I'm certainly not saying that, but others might find it convenient to say that.
Stay with me. Here's Margaret in Tandragee. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Stephen, I hold two passports. I hold an Irish passport and a British passport. Now, the reason I got my Irish passport because my mother was born in Dublin before 1922, as was my grandmother. They all lived in Dublin, what came up before partition. Now, the reason I got the Irish passport, because I was going to the States, and if you had an Irish passport, you didn't have to go wobbling around getting visas. And that's the only reason I got it.
And do you think it's going to be valuable going forward?
Well, why not?
Thank you, Margaret. Stephen Ballamoney. Morning, Steve.
Morning, Stephen. How are you?
Go ahead, Steve.
I want to know, if I'm out in Spain and I'm coming back and I have an Irish passport, you know, whenever you're only allowed 200 cigarettes and a bottle of wine, if I come back as an Irish citizen, can I not bring back as much as I want because it's for personal use? May not be a bit of a laugh at the airport, wouldn't it? I would say that they'll be queuing up for an Irish passport so they can get their ciggies back and their beer back and all the rest of it.
Steve, thank you. Jim in North Belfast. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Doing all right this morning.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
If we're entitled to have two passports, as you do indeed yourself, say you were up in court and a judge wanted you to surrender your passport, you could surrender one and still abscond on the other one.
You could do what?
You could surrender one passport to a court, but you could still leave the country on the other passport.
Ah, come on.
What do you mean, ah, come on?
No, you couldn't.
Why not?
It'd be ridiculous.
Well, what if a judge asks you for your passport and you give him it?
Yes.
But you've still got one in the house. You go to the airport and you jump the plane and away you go.
Welcome to the Nolan Show, Newton.
Welcome.
Well, look, there's an amazing complication on this issue that only Sinn Féin actually has really raised so far, which is that it doesn't matter what passport you hold. We are all in Northern Ireland, or nearly all of us, already Irish and British citizens by birthright. So shouldn't we all keep all our EU rights, whether we apply for a British or Irish passport or not?
That's the point I'm trying to get at this morning. That if we automatically have those rights, then we automatically are in a different situation than people in England, Scotland and Wales. So this narrative that we hear, Newton, of we cannot be any different than the rest of the UK, we already are. Right.
Yes, and that, I think that's why they've tried to tone down the promises made between the two withdrawal agreements. Originally, last December, the agreement between the UK and Brussels said we'd keep all our rights as EU citizens, even where we reside in Northern Ireland. And the latest one, which was out in March, simply said that we'd keep all our rights under the Good Friday Agreement, and we can easily do that. But that is a much tighter category. For example, under the Good Friday Agreement, well, its territorial extent is only the UK and Ireland. So we can continue moving and working around the UK and Ireland under the common travel area. That's not going to be affected. But will that be enough for people? I think it's pretty clear that it won't.
Last question, Newton. If we don't understand some of this, how much do you think some of the Conservative MPs across the water understand about Northern Irish affairs and the border issues?
Well, now, the news does and social media does have an amplifying effect on people who make mistakes or who make daft remarks. So, you know, you perhaps ignorance is a little bit overrepresented. But yes, this is a very complicated subject that not everyone's on top of. That's for sure.